Teruel. The white horse must come to the hunter, and you must take her there. This is the ordering of things. You have forgotten. The river is coming to the valley, and the white horse must come to the hunter. Then we shall see what we shall see. We have work to do, Will.
And the rain beat down on them harder. And somewhere distant thunder rumbled in the early night, as the huge Shire horse Pollux splashed patiently on through the rising brown river that had once been Huntercombe Lane. It was impossible to tell where they were. A wind was rising, and Will could hear the sounds of swaying trees above the steady churning of Pollux's feet. Scarcely a light showed in the village. He supposed that the electric power must still be cut off, either by accident or by agent of the dark. In any case, most of the people of this part of the village were still at the manor.
"Where's Merriman?" he called through the loud rain.
"At the manor," George shouted in his ear. "With Farmer. Beset."
"You mean they're trapped?"
Will's voice turned shrill with alarm. Old George said, hissing close, hard to hear.
"They hold attention so we may work. And floods make them busy too. Look down, boy."
In the churning water, the light from the sign showed a scatter of unlikely objects bobbing past. A wicker basket, several disintegrating cardboard boxes, a bright red candle, some tangled strands of ribbon. Suddenly, Will recognized one piece of ribbon, a lurid purple and yellow check, as a wrapping he had seen Mary carefully pull off a parcel and roll up on Christmas Day. She was a great hoarder, like a squirrel. This had gone into her hoard.
"Those things are from our house, George."
"Floods there too," the old man said. "Land's low, no danger though, be easy, just water and mud."
Will knew he was right, but again he longed to see for himself. Rushing about, they would all be, moving furniture and rugs, clearing books and everything movable. These first floating objects must have escaped before anyone noticed the water was actually carrying things off. Pollock stumbled for the first time, and Will clutched at the wet chestnut mane. For a moment he had almost slipped and been carried off himself. George made soothing noises, and the big horse sighed and snuffled through his nose. Will could see a few dim lights now that must come from the bigger houses on high ground at the end of the village. That meant they must be nearing the common, if it was still the common, and not a lake. Something was changing. He blinked. The water seemed further away, harder to see. Then he realized that the light from the signs linked on his wrist was growing dim, fading away to nothing. In a moment, they were in darkness. As soon as all the light had died, old George said softly,
"Oh, Polly."
And the great Shire horse splashed to a halt and stood there with the water rippling past his legs. George said,
"This is where I have to leave you, Will."
"Oh,"
Will said, forlorn.
"There is the one instruction,"
old George said,
"that you are to take the white horse to the hunter. That will happen if you fall into no trouble. And there are two bits of advice to keep you from trouble, just from me to you. The first is that you will find enough light to see by if you stand for a count of 100 after I am gone. The second is to remember what you know already. The moving water is free of magic."
He patted Will comfortingly on the shoulder.
"Put the signs round your waist again now," he said, "and get down."
It was a wet business getting down, worse than getting up. Pollux was so high from the ground that Will splashed into the water like a falling brick. Yet he felt no cold, though the rain beat at him still. It was gentle, and in some curious way it seemed to keep him from being chilled. Old George said again,
"I go to gather the hunt."
And with no other word of farewell, he set Pollux splashing off again towards the common, and was gone. Will clambered up the snowbank beside the river road, found space to stand without toppling, and began counting up to 100. Before he had reached 70, he began to see what old George had meant. Gradually, the dark world was taking on a glimmer of light from within itself. The rushing water, the pitted snow, the gaunt trees, he could see them all in a grey dead light, like dawn. And while he looked round, puzzling, something floating past him on the quick stream brought him such astonishment that he almost fell into the water again. He saw the antlers first, turning lazily from side to side as if the great head were nodding to itself. Then the colours showed, the bright blues and yellows and reds, just as he had first seen them on Christmas morning. He could not see the details of the strange face, the bird-like eyes, the pricked ears of the wolf, but it was his carnival head, without a doubt, the inexplicable present that the old Jamaican had given Stephen to give to him, his most precious possession in the world. Will let out a noise like a sob and leapt forward desperately to seize it before the water carried it out of reach. But he slipped as he jumped, and by the time he had recovered his balance, the bright, grotesque head was bobbing out of sight. Will began to run along the bank. It was a thing of the old ones and from Stephen, and he had lost it. He must at all costs get it back. But memory caught him in mid-stride, and he paused.
"Second thing," old George had said, "is to remember that moving water is free of magic."
The head was in moving water, only too clearly. So long as it remained there, no one could harm it or use it for the wrong ends. Reluctantly, Will put it out of his mind. The great open common stretched before him, lit by a strange glimmer of its own. Nothing moved. Even the cattle that normally grazed there year-round, looming up out of nowhere on misty days like solid ghosts, were away under cover now on the farms, driven off by the snow. Will moved on carefully. Then the noise of the water that had been in his ears for so long began to change, growing louder, and before him the torrent-filling Huntercombe Lane turned aside, joining a tiny local stream that had swollen now into a foaming river rushing over the common and away. The road that had been the river road wound on, unhindered, solid and gleaming. Old George, Will sensed, had gone that way. He would have liked to take the road too, but he felt that he was to stay with the river. Through the extra sense of the old ones, he knew that it would show him how to take the white horse to the hunter. But who was the hunter? And where was the white horse? Will went gingerly forward along the lumpy snowbank edging the new swollen stream. Willows lined it, squat and pollarded. Then suddenly, out of the dark line of trees on the far side of the stream, a white shape leapt. There was a glimmer of silver in the darkness that was not quite dark, and in a spray of wet snow the great white mare of the light was standing before Will, her breath clouding round the streaks of rain. She was tall as a tree, her mane blown wild by the wind. Will touched her gently. "Will you carry me?" he said in the old speech. "As you did before." The wind spurted as he spoke, and bright lightning flashed jagged round the edge of the sky, closer than it had been. The white horse shuddered, her head jerking up. But she relaxed again almost at once, and Will too felt instinctively that this brewing thunderstorm was not a storm of the dark. It was expected. It was part of what was to come. The light was rising before the dark could rise. He made sure the signs were secure on his belt. And then, as once before, he reached up to wind his fingers in the long coarse hair of the white mane. Instantly his head spun in giddiness, and clear but far off he heard his same music, bell-like and haunting, the same heart-catching phrase. Till with a great jolt the world turned, the music vanished, and he was up on the back of the white mare, high among the willow trees. Lightning was flickering all round the growling sky now. Muscles bunched in the tremendous back beneath Will, and he gripped the long mane as the horse leapt out across the common, out over the hillocks and ravines of snow, its hooves grazing the surface to leave a wake of icy spray. Through the rush of the wind he thought, as he clung close to the mare's arched neck, that he could hear a strange high yelping in the wind, like the sound of migrating geese flying high. The sound seemed to curve around them, and then to go on ahead, dying out of range. The white horse leapt high. Will clung tighter as they rose over hedges, roads, walls, all emerging from the melting snow. Then a new noise, louder than the wind or the thunder, was in his ears, and he saw glinting, ruffled black glass ahead of them, and he knew that they had come to the Thames. The river was far wider than he had ever seen it here. For more than a week it had been shut tight and narrow by icy walls of overhanging snow. Now it had broken loose, foaming and roaring, with great chunks of snow and ice tossing like icebergs. This was not a river. It was a fury of water. It hissed and howled. It was not reasonable. As he looked, Will was frightened as he had never been by the Thames. It was as wild as a thing of the dark could be, out of his knowledge or control. Yet he knew it was not of the dark, but beyond either light or dark, one of the ancient things from the beginning of time. The ancient things. Fire, water, stone, wood. And then, after the beginning of men, bronze and iron. The river was loose, and would go according to its own will.
"The river will come to the valley," Merriman had said.
The white mare paused irresolute on the edge of the wild, cold water, then surged forward and leapt. It was only as they rose over the churning river that Will saw the island, an island where none had been before in this swollen torrent, divided by strange, glinting channels. He thought as the white horse jolted him to earth again among bare, dark trees. It's a hill, really, a piece of high ground cut off by the water. And suddenly he knew very clearly that he would meet great danger here. This was his place of testing. This island that was not an island. Once more he looked up into the sky and silently, desperately called for Merriman. But Merriman did not come, and no word or sign from him came into Will's mind. The storm was not breaking yet, and the wind had dropped a little. The noise of the river was louder than all else. The white mare bent her long neck, and Will scrambled awkwardly down. Through the mounded snow, sometimes ice hard and sometimes soft enough to drop him thigh deep, he set out to explore his strange island. He had thought it a circle, but it was shaped like an egg, its highest point at the end where the white mare stood. Trees grew round the foot. Above them was an open, snowy slope. Above that, a cap of rough scrub dominated by a single gnarled ancient beech tree. Out of the snow at the foot of this great tree, most perplexingly, four streams ran down over the hill island, dividing it into four quarters. The white horse stood motionless. Thunder rumbled out of the flickering sky. Will climbed to the old beech tree and stood watching the nearest spring foam out from beneath a huge snow-mounded root. And the singing began. It was wordless. It came in the wind. It was a thin, high, cold whine with no definable tune or pattern. It came from a long way off, and it was not pleasant to hear. But it held him transfixed, turning his thoughts away from their proper direction, turning them away from everything except contemplation of whatever happened to be closest at hand. Will felt he was growing roots like the tree above him. As he listened to the singing, he saw a twig on a low branch of the beech close to his head that seemed for no reason so totally enthralling that he could do nothing but gaze at it, as if it contained the whole world. He stared for so long, his eyes moving very gradually along the tiny twig and back again, that he felt as if several months had passed while the high, strange singing went on and on in the sky from its distant beginnings. And then suddenly it stopped, and he was left standing dazed with his nose almost touching a very ordinary beech twig. He knew then that the dark had its own way of putting even an old one outside time for a space, if they needed a space for their own magic. For before him, next to the trunk of the great beech, stood Hawken. He was more recognizably Hawken now, though still the walker in age. Will felt that he was looking at two men in one. Hawken was dressed still in his green velvet coat. It seemed still fresh with the touch of white lace at the neck. But the figure within the coat was no longer neat and lithe. It was smaller, bent and shrunk by age. And the face was lined and battered beneath long, wisping grey hair. The centuries that had beaten at Hawken had left only his sharp, bright eyes unchanged. Those eyes looked at Will now with cold hostility across the mounded snow.
"Your sister is here," Hawken said.
Will could not stop himself from glancing quickly round the island, but it was empty as before. He said coldly, "She is not here." You're not going to catch me with a silly trick like that. The eyes narrowed.
You are arrogant,
Hawken hissed.
You do not see all that is to be known in the world, old one with a gift. Nor do your masters. Your sister Mary is here, in this place, though she is not to be seen by you. This is a meeting for the only bargain that my lord the rider will make. Your sister, for the signs. You scarcely have much choice. You people are good at risking the lives of others.
The bitter old mouth curved up in a sneer.
But I do not think Will Stanton would enjoy watching his sister die.
Will said, I can't see her. I still don't believe she's here. Staring at him, Hawkins said to the empty air,
Master!
And at once the high, wordless singing began again, catching Will back into the slow contemplation that was warm and relaxing as the summer sun, but at the same time horrible in its soft clutch of the mind. It changed him while he was listening, made him forget the tension of fighting for the light, submerged him this time in watching the way the shadows and hollows made patterns on a patch of snow near his feet. He stood there loose and relaxed, gazing at a point of white ice here, a hollow of darkness there, and the singing whined in his ears like the wind through chinks in a crumbling house. And then again it stopped, and there was nothing. And Will saw with a shock like sudden cold that he was staring not at a pattern of mere shadows on snow, but at the lines and curves of his sister Mary's face. There she lay on the snow, in the clothes she had worn when he last saw her, alive and unharmed, but gazing blankly up at him without any sign that she recognized him or knew where she was. Indeed, Will thought unhappily, he did not know where she was either, for although he was being shown the appearance of her, it was most unlikely that she was really there, lying on the snow. He moved to touch her, and as he expected, she vanished completely away, and only the shadows lay on the snow as before.
You see, said Hawken, unmoving beside the beech tree, there are some things that the dark can do, many things, over which you and your masters have no control at all.
That's pretty obvious, Will said. Otherwise there wouldn't be such a thing as the dark, would there? We could just tell it to go away. Hawken smiled, unruffled. He said softly,
But it will never go away. Once it comes, it breaks all resistance into nothing. And the dark will always come, my young friend, and always win. As you see, we have your sister. Now you will give me the signs.
Give them to you, Will said with scorn. To a worm who crawled to the other side.
Never.
He saw the fists clench briefly at the cuffs of the green velvet jacket. But this was an old, old Hawken, not to be drawn. He had himself under control now that he was no longer the wandering walker, but part of the dark. There was only a small catch of fury in the voice.
You would do well to deal with the messenger of the dark, boy. If you will not, you may call up more than you will wish to see.
The sky flickered and rumbled, bringing a brief bright light to the dark roaring water all round, the great tree peaking the tiny island, the bowed green-jacketed figure beside its trunk. Will said,
You are a creature of the dark. You chose betrayal. You are nothing. I will not deal with you.
Hawkins' face twisted as he stared venomously at him. Then he looked towards the dark, empty common and called,
Master!
Then again an angry shriek this time, Master! Will stood, tranquil, waiting. On the edge of the island he saw the white mare of the light, almost invisible against the snow, raise her head and sniff the air, snorting softly. She looked once towards Will as if in communication, then wheeled round in the direction from which they had come, and galloped away. Within seconds, something came. There was no sound, still, but the rushing river and the grumbling, looming storm. The thing that came was utterly silent. It was huge, a column of black mist like a tornado, whirling at enormous speed upright between the land and the sky. At either end it seemed broad and solid, but the centre wavered, grew slender, and then thicker again. It wove to and fro as it came, in a kind of macabre dance. It was a hole in the world, this whirling black spectre. A piece of the eternal emptiness of the dark made visible. As it came closer and closer to the island, bending and weaving, Will could not help backing away. Every part of him shouted silently in alarm. The black pillar swayed before him, covering the whole island. Its whirling, silent mist did not change, but parted, and standing within it was the Black Rider. He stood with the mist wreathing round his hands and head, and smiled at Will. A cold, mirthless smile, with the heavy bars of eyebrows furrowed and ominous above. He was all in black again, but the clothes were unexpectedly modern. He wore a heavy black donkey jacket and rough, dark denim trousers. Without a flicker in the chill smile, he moved aside a little, and out of the snaking black mist of the column came his horse, the great black beast with fiery eyes, and on its back sat Mary.
"Hello, Will,"
Mary said cheerfully. Will looked at her.
"Hello. I suppose you were looking for me," Mary said. "I hope nobody got worried. I only went for a little ride, just for a minute or two. I mean, when I went looking for Max. And then I met Mr. Metothin and found Dad had sent him to look for me. Well, obviously, it was all right. I had a lovely ride. It's a super horse. It's such a lovely day now."
The thunder rumbled behind the massing grey-black cloud. Will shifted unhappily. The rider, watching him, said loudly,
"Here's some sugar for the horse, Mary. I think he deserves it, don't you?"
And he held out his hand, empty.
"Oh, thank you,"
Mary said eagerly. She leaned forward over the horse's neck and took the imaginary sugar from the rider's hand. Then she reached down beside the stallion's mouth, and the animal licked briefly at her palm. Mary beamed.
"There," she said. "Is that good?"
The black rider still gazed at Will, his smile widening a little. He opened his palm in mockery of Mary, and lying in it, Will saw a small white box, made of an icy translucent glass with lines of runic symbols engraved on the lid.
"Here I have her, old one,"
said the rider, his nasal accented voice softly triumphant.
"Caught by the marks of the old spell of Leah, that was written long ago on a certain ring and then lost. You should have looked more closely at your mother's ring, you and that simple craftsman, your father, and Lion, your careless master. Careless. Under that spell, I have your sister bound by totem magic. And yourself bound, too. Powerless to rescue her. See?"
He flicked the little box open, and Will saw lying in it a round, delicately carved piece of wood, wound about with a fragile gold thread. With dismay he remembered the only ornament that had been missing from the Christmas collection carved by Farmer Dawson for the Stanton family, and the golden hair that Mr. Metothin, his father's visitor, had with casual courtesy flicked away from Mary's sleeve.
"A birth sign and a hair of the head are excellent totems," the rider said. "In the old days, when we were all less sophisticated, you could, of course, work the magic even through the ground a man's foot had trod." "Or where his shadow had passed," Will said. "But the dark casts no shadow," the rider said softly. "And an old one has no birth sign. said Will.
He saw uncertainty flicker over the intent white face. The rider shut the white box and slipped it into his pocket.
Nonsense, he said curtly.
Will looked at him thoughtfully. He said, The masters of the light do nothing without reason, Ryder, even though the reason may not be known for years and years. 11 years ago, Farmer Dawson of the Light carved a certain sign for me at my birth, and if he had made the sign with the letter of my name, as the tradition was, then perhaps you could have used it to trap me into your power. But he made it in the sign of the light, a circle cut by a cross. And as you know well, the dark can use nothing of that shape for its own purpose. It is forbidden.
He looked up at the rider. He said,
I think you are trying to bluff me again, Mr. Mitothin. Mr. Mitothin? Black Rider of the Black Horse?
The rider scowled.
Yet still you are powerless, he said, for I have your sister, and you cannot save her except by giving me the signs.
Malignance glittered again in his eyes.
Your great and noble book may have told you that I cannot harm those who are of the same blood as an old one. But look at her. She will do anything that I suggest she should do. Even jump into this swollen Thames. There are parts of the craft that you people neglect, you know. It is so simple to persuade folk into situations where they bring accidents upon themselves. Like your mother, for instance, so clumsy.
He smiled again at Will. Will stared back, hating him. Then he looked at Mary's happy, sleeping, waking face, and ached that she should be in such a place. He thought, and all because she's my sister. All because of me. But a silent voice said into his mind,
Not because of you. Because of the light. Because of all that must always happen to keep the dark from rising.
And with a surge of joy, Will knew that he was no longer alone, that because the rider was abroad, Merriman was nearby again too, free to give help if need be. The rider put out his hand.
This is the time for your bargain, Will Stanton. Give me the signs.
Will took the deepest breath of his life and let it out slowly. He said,
No.
Astonishment was an emotion that the Black Rider had forgotten long ago. The piercing blue eyes stared at Will in total disbelief.
But you know what I shall do.
Yes, Will said. I know. But I will not give you the signs.
For a long moment, the rider looked at him out of the vast black pillar of swirling mist in which he stood. In his face, incredulity and rage were mingled with a kind of evil respect. Then he swung round to the black horse and to Mary and called aloud some words in a language that Will guessed, from the chill they put into his bones, must be the spell speech of the dark, seldom used aloud. The great horse tossed his head, white teeth flashing, and bounded forward with happy, witless Mary clutching his mane and gurgling with laughter. He came to the overhanging snowbank that bordered the river and paused. Will clenched the signs on his belt, agonized by the risk he was taking, and with all his might summoned the power of the light to come to his aid. The black horse gave a shrill, shrieking whinny and leapt high into the air over the Thames. Halfway through his leap, he twisted strangely, bucking in the air, and Mary screamed in terror, grabbing wildly at his neck. But her balance was gone, and she fell. Will thought he would faint as she turned through the air, his risk bursting into disaster. But instead of splashing into the river, she fell into the soft, wet snow at its brink. The Black Rider cursed savagely, lunging forward. He never reached her.
Before he was in mid-stride, a great arrow of lightning came from the storm amassed now almost overhead, and a gigantic crack of thunder, and out of the flash and the roar, a blazing white streak rushed over the island towards Mary, catching her up so that in an instant she was gone, seized away, safe. Will hardly managed to get a glimpse of Merriman's lean form, cloaked and hooded on the white mare of the light, with Mary's blonde hair flying where he held her. Then the storm broke, and the whole world whirled flaming round his head. The earth rocked. He saw for an instant Windsor Castle outlined black against a white sky. Lightning seared his eyes, thunder beat at his head. Then, through the singing in his dazed ears, he heard a strange creaking and crackling close by. He swung round. Behind him, the great beech tree was cleft down the middle, blazing with great flames. And he realized with amazement that the eager current of the island's four streams was growing less and less, dwindling down to nothing. He looked up fearfully for the black column of the dark, but it was nowhere to be seen in the raging storm, and the strangeness of all else that was happening drove the thought of it out of Will's head. For it was not only the tree that had been split and broken. The island itself was changing, breaking open, sinking towards the river. Will stared, speechless, standing now on an edge of snow-mounded land left by the vanished streams, while around him snow and land slid and crumpled into the roaring Thames. Above him, he saw the strangest thing of all. Something was emerging out of the island as the land and snow fell away. There came first, from what had been the taller end of the island, the roughly shaped head of a stag, antlers held high. It was golden, glinting even in that dim light. More came into sight. Will could see the whole stag now, a beautiful golden image, prancing. Then came a curious curved pedestal on which it stood as if to leap away. Then behind this a long, long horizontal shape, as long as the island, rising again at the other end to another high, gold-glinting point, tipped this time by a kind of scroll. And suddenly Will realized that he was looking at a ship. The pedestal was its high, curving prow, and the stag its figurehead. Astounded, he moved towards it, and imperceptibly the river moved after him, until there was nothing left of the island but the long ship on a last circle of land, with a last rearing snowdrift all around it. Will stood staring. He had never seen such a ship. The long timbers of which it was built overlapped one another like the boards of a fence, heavy and broad. They looked like oak. He could see no mast. Instead, there were places for row upon row of oarsmen up and down the whole length of the vessel. In the centre was a kind of deckhouse that made the ship look almost like a Noah's Ark. It was not a closed structure. Its sides seemed to have been cut away, leaving the corner beams and roof like a canopy. And inside, beneath the canopy, a king lay. Will drew back a little at the sight of him. The mailed figure lay very still with sword and shield at his side, and treasure piled round him in glittering mounds. He wore no crown. Instead, a great engraved helmet covered the head and most of the face, crested by a heavy silver image of a long-snouted animal that Will thought must be a wild boar. But even without a crown, this was clearly the body of a king. No lesser man could have merited the silver dishes and jewelled purses, the great shield of bronze and iron, the ornate scabbard, the gold-rimmed drinking horns, and the heaps of ornaments. On an impulse, Will knelt down in the snow and bowed his head in respect. As he looked up again, rising, he saw over the gunwale of the ship something he had not noticed before. The king was holding something in his hands, where they lay tranquilly folded on his breast. It was another ornament, small and glittering. And as Will saw it more closely, he stood still as stone, gripping the high oaken edge of the ship. The ornament in the quiet hands of the longship king was shaped as a circle, quartered by a cross. It was wrought of iridescent glass, engraved with serpents and eels and fishes, waves and clouds and things of the sea. It called silently to Will. It was, without any question, the sign of water, the last of the six great signs. Will scrambled over the side of the great ship and approached the king. He had to take care where his feet moved, or he would have crushed fine work of engraved leather and woven robes, and jewellery of enamels and cloisonne and filigree gold. He stood looking down for a moment at the white face half hidden by the ornate helmet, and then he reached reverently across to take the sign. But first he had to touch the hand of the dead king, and it was colder than any stone. Will flinched and drew back, hesitating. Merriman's voice said softly from close by, "Do not fear him." Will swallowed. "But he's dead." "He has lain here in his burial ground for 1,500 years, waiting. On any other night of the year he would not be here at all. He would be dust. Yes, Will, this appearance of him is dead. The rest of him has gone out beyond time long since."
"But it's wrong to take tribute away from the dead."
"It is the sign. If it had not been the sign and destined for you, the sign-seeker, he would not be here to give it to you. Take it."
So Will leaned across the bier and took the sign of water from the loose grip of the dead cold hands, and from somewhere far off a murmur of his music whispered in his ears, and then was gone. He turned to the side of the ship. There beside it was Merriman sitting on the white mare. He was cloaked in dark blue with his wild white hair uncovered. The hollows of his bony face were dark with strain, but delight gleamed in his eyes.
"It was well done, Will," he said.
Will was gazing at the sign in his hands. The sheen over it was the iridescence of all mother-of-pearl, all rainbows. The light danced on it as it danced on water.
"It's beautiful," he said.
Rather reluctantly, he loosened the end of the belt and slipped the sign of water on, to lie next to the glimmering sign of fire.
"It is one of the oldest," Merriman said, "and the most powerful. Now that you have it, they lose their power over Mary forever. That spell is dead. Come. We must go."
Concern sharpened his voice. He had seen Will grasped hastily at a beam as the longship suddenly, unexpectedly lurched to one side. It rose upright, swayed a little, then tipped in the opposite direction. Will saw, scrambling for the side, that the Thames had risen still further while he was not watching. Water lapped round the great ship, and had it almost afloat. Not for long now would the dead king rest on the land that had once been an island. The mare wheeled towards him, snuffling a greeting, and in the same enchanted, music-haunted moment as before, Will was up on the white horse of the light, sitting in front of Merriman. The ship tilted and swung, fully afloat now, and the white horse wheeled out of its way to stand nearby, watching, the river water foaming round its sturdy legs. Creaking and rattling, the longship gave itself to the rush of the swollen Thames. It was too large a vessel to be overwhelmed. Its weight kept it steady even on that swirling water once it had found a balance. So the mysterious dead king lay in dignity still among his weapons and gleaming tribute, and Will had a last glimpse of the mask-like white face as the great ship moved away downstream. He said over his shoulder, "Who was he?" There was grave respect on Merriman's face as he watched the longship go.
"An English king of the Dark Ages. I think we will not use his name. The Dark Ages were rightly named, a shadowy time for the world, when the Black Riders rode unhindered over all our land. Only the old ones and a few noble, brave men like this one kept the light alive."
"And he was buried in a ship, like the Vikings."
Will was watching the light glimmer on the golden stag of the prow.
"He was part Viking himself," Merriman said. There were 3 great ship burials near this Thames of yours in days past. One was dug up in the last century near Taplow and destroyed in the process. One was this ship of the light, not destined ever to be found by men. And one was the greatest ship of the greatest king of all. And this they have not found, and perhaps never will. It lies in peace.
He stopped abruptly, and at a movement of his hand the white horse turned, ready to leap away from the river to the south. But Will was still straining to watch the longship, and something of his tension seemed to infect both horse and master. They paused. In that moment, an extraordinary streak of blue light came hurtling out of the east, not from the thundering sky, but from somewhere across the common. It struck the ship. A great silent rush of flame burst there over the broad river and its craggy white banks, and from prow to stern the king's ship was outlined by leaping fire. Will gave a choking, wordless cry, and the white horse stirred uneasily, pawing at the snow. Behind Will, Merriman's strong, deep voice said,
"They vent their spite because they know they are too late. Very easy it is, now and again, to predict what the dark will do."
Will said, "But the king, and all his beautiful things."
"If the rider paused for thought, Will, he would have known that his outburst of malice has done no more than create a right and proper ending for this great ship. When this king's father died, he was laid in a ship in the same way, with all his most splendid possessions round him, but the ship was not buried. That was not the way. The king's men set fire to it and sent it off burning alone over the sea, a tremendous sailing pyre. And that, look, is what our king of the last sign is doing now, sailing in fire and water to his long rest, down the greatest river of England, towards the sea."
"And good rest to him,"
Will said softly, turning his eyes at last from the leaping flames. But for a long time afterwards, wherever they went, they could see the glow from the blazing longship whitening a part of the storm-dark sky. The Hunt Rides.
"Come," Merriman said, "we must lose no more time."
And the white mare wheeled them round away from the river and rose into the air, skimming the foaming water, crossing the Thames to the side that is the end of Buckinghamshire, the beginning of Berkshire. She leapt with desperate speed, yet still Merriman urged her on. Will knew why. He had glimpsed through the flowing folds of Merriman's blue cloak the great black tornado column of the dark, gathered again even larger than before, bridging earth and sky, whirling silently in the glow of the burning ship. It was following them, and it was moving very fast. A wind came up out of the east and lashed at them. The cloak blew forward round Will, enfolding him as if he and Merriman were shut in a great blue tent.
"This is the peak of it all,"
Merriman shouted into his ear, shouting his loudest but still scarcely to be heard over the rising howl of the wind.
"You have the 6 signs, but they are not yet joined. If the dark can take you now, they take all that they need to rise to power. Now they will try hardest of all."
On they galloped, past houses and shops and unwitting people fighting the floods, past roofs and chimneys, over hedges, across fields, through trees, never far from the ground. The great black column pursued them, rushing on the wind, and in it and through it rode the black rider on his fire-jawed black horse, spurring after them, with the lords of the dark riding at his shoulder like a spinning dark cloud themselves. The white mare rose again, and Will looked down. Trees were everywhere below them now, great single-spreading oaks and beeches in open fields, and then tight-growing woods split by long straight avenues. Surely they were galloping down one such avenue now, past brooding snow-weighed fir-trees and out again into open land. Lightning flashed at his left side, leaping in the depths of a huge cloud, and in its light he saw the dark mass of Windsor Castle looming high and close. He thought, if that's the castle, we must be in the great park. He began to feel, too, that they were no longer alone. Twice already he had heard again that strange high yelping in the sky, but now there was more. Beings of his own kind were about here somewhere, in the tree-thronged park, And he felt, too, that the grey-massed sky was no longer empty of life, but peopled with creatures neither of the dark nor of the light, moving to and fro, clustering and separating, holding great power. The white mare was down in the snow again now, the hooves pounding over drift and slush and icy paths, more deliberately than before. All at once Will realized that she was not responding to Merriman, as he had thought, but following some profound impulse of her own. Lightning flickered again round them, and the sky roared. Merriman said beside his ear, "Do you know Herne's Oak?"
"Yes, of course,"
Will said at once. He had known the local legend all his life.
"Is that where we are? The big oak tree in the great park where—"
He swallowed.
How could he not have thought of it?
Why had Grammarly taught him everything but this?
He went on slowly,
"Where Herne the Hunter is supposed to ride on the eve of Twelfth Night."
Then he looked round fearfully at Merriman.
"Herne!"
"I go to gather the hunt,"
old George had said.
Merriman said, "Of course. Tonight the hunt rides. And because you have played your part well, tonight for the first time in more than 1,000 years, the hunt will have a quarry."
The white mare slowed, sniffing the air. Winds were breaking the sky apart. A half-moon sailed high through the clouds, then vanished again. Lightning danced in 6 places at once. The clouds roared and growled. The black pillar of the dark came hurtling towards them, then paused, spinning and undulating, hovering between land and sky. Merriman said,
"An old way rings the great park. The way through Hunter's Coombe. They will take a little while to find their path past that."
Will was straining to see ahead through the murk. In the intermittent light, he could make out the shape of a solitary oak tree, spreading great arms from its short, tremendous trunk. Unlike most other trees in sight, it bore not the smallest remnant of snow, and a shadow stood beside its trunk, the size of a man. The white mare saw the shadow at the same time. She blew hard through her nose and pawed the ground. Will said to himself very softly,
"The white horse must go to the hunter."
Merriman touched him on the shoulder, and with swift, enchanted ease they slid down to the ground. The mare bent her head to them, and Will laid his hand on the tough, smooth, white neck.
"Oh, my friend,"
Merriman said, and the horse swung about and trotted eagerly towards the huge, solitary oak tree and the mysterious shadow motionless beneath. The creature who owned that shadow was of immense power. Will flinched before the sense of it. The moon went behind the clouds again. For a while there was no lightning. In the gloom they could see nothing move beneath the tree. One sound came through the darkness, a whinny of greeting from the white mare. As if in counterpoint, a deeper snuffling whinny came out of the trees beside them. As Will swung round, the moon sailed clear of cloud again, and he saw the huge silhouette of Pollux, the shire horse from Dawson's farm, with old George high on his back.
"Your sister is at home, boy," old George said. "She got lost, you know, and fell asleep in an old barn, and had such a curious dream that she is already forgetting."
Will nodded gratefully and smiled. But he was gazing at a curious, rounded shape, muffled by wrapping that George held before him.
"What's that?"
His neck was tingling even from being close to it, whatever it was. Old George did not answer. He leant down to Merriman.
"Is all well?"
"All goes well," Merriman said.
He shivered and drew his long cloak round him.
"Give it to the boy."
He looked hard at Will out of his inscrutable, deep-set eyes, and Will, wondering, went towards the cart horse and stood at George's knee, looking up. With a quick, mirthless grin that seemed to mask great strain, the old man lowered the shadowed burden towards him. It was half as large as Will himself, though not heavy. It was wrapped in sacking. As he laid hands on it, Will knew instantly what it was. "It can't be," he thought incredulously. "What would be the point?" Thunder rumbled again, all around. Merriman's voice said, deep in the shadows behind him,
"But of course it is. The water brought it. in safety. Then the old ones took it from the water at the proper time. And now,
old George said from his place high on patient Pollux,
you must take it to the hunter, young old one.
Will swallowed nervously. An old one had nothing in the world to fear, nothing. Yet there had been something so strange and awesome about that shadowy figure beneath the giant oak, something that made one feel unnecessary, insignificant, small. He straightened. Unnecessary was the wrong word, at any rate. He had a task to perform. Raising his burden like a standard, he pulled away its covering, and the bright, eerie carnival head that was half man, half beast, emerged as smooth and gay as if it had just arrived from its distant island. The antlers stood up proudly. He saw that they were exactly the shape of those on the golden stag, the figurehead to the dead king's ship. Holding the mask before him, he walked firmly towards the deep shadow of the broad-spreading oak. At its edge, he paused. He could see a glimmer of white from the mare, moving gently in recognition. He could see that the mare had a rider, but that was all. The figure on the horse bent down towards him. He did not see the face, but only felt the mask lifted from his hands, and his hands fell back as if they had been relieved of a great weight, even though the head had from the beginning seemed so light. He backed away. The moon came sailing suddenly out from behind a cloud, and for a moment his eyes dazzled as he looked full into its cold white light. Then it was gone again, and the white horse was moving out of the shadow, with the figure on its back changed in outline against the dim-lit sky. The rider had a head now that was bigger than the head of a man and horned with the antlers of a stag, and the white mare bearing this monstrous stag man was moving inexorably towards Will. He stood, waiting, until the great horse came close. Its nose gently touched his shoulder once for the last time. The figure of the hunter towered over him. The moonlight now glimmered clear on his head, and Will found himself gazing up into strange, tawny eyes, yellow-gold, unfathomable, like the eyes of some huge bird. He gazed into the hunter's eyes, and he heard in the sky that strange high yelping begin again. With the difficulty of escaping an enchantment, he dragged his gaze aside to look properly at the head, the great horned mask that he had given the hunter to put on. But the head was real. The golden eyes blinked, feather-fringed and round, with the deliberate blink of an owl's strong eyelids. The man's face in which they were set was turned full on Will, and the firm, carved mouth above the soft beard parted in a quick smile. That mouth troubled Will. It was not the mouth of an old one. It could smile in friendship, but there were other lines round it as well. Where Merriman's face was marked with lines of sadness and anger, the hunter's told instead of cruelty and a pitiless impulse to revenge. Indeed, he was half-beast. The dark branches of Herne's antlers curved up over Will, the moonlight glinting on their velvety sheen, and the hunter laughed softly. He looked down at Will out of his yellow eyes, in the face that was no longer a mask, but living, and he spoke in a voice like a tenor bell. "The signs, old one," he said. "Show me the signs." Without taking his eyes from the towering figure, Will fumbled with his buckle and held the six-quartered circles high in the moonlight. The hunter looked at them and bent his head. When he raised it again, slowly, the soft voice was half-singing, half-chanting words that Will had heard before. "When the dark comes rising, six shall turn it back. Three from the circle, three from the track. Wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone, five will return and one go alone. Iron for the birthday, bronze carried long, wood from the burning, stone out of song, fire in the candle ring, water from the thaw, six signs the circle and the grail gone before." But he too did not end where Will expected him to. He went on. "Fire on the mountain shall find the harp of gold, played to wake the sleepers, oldest of the old. Power from the green witch, lost beneath the sea. All shall find the light at last, silver on the tree.
The yellow eyes looked at Will again, but they did not see him now.
They had grown cold, abstracted, a chill fire mounting in them that brought the cruel lines back to the face. But Will saw the cruelty now as the fierce inevitability of nature. It was not from malice that the light and the servants of the light would ever hound the dark, but from the nature of things. Herne the Hunter wheeled round on the great white horse away from Will and the single oak tree until his fearsome silhouette was in the open, under the moon and the still lowering storm clouds. He raised his head, and he made to the sky a call that was like the halloo blown by a huntsman on the horn to call up hounds. The hunting horn of his voice seemed to grow and grow and to fill the sky and come from a thousand throats at once. And Will saw that this it did, for from every point of the park, behind every shadow or tree and out of every cloud, leaping round the ground and through the air came an endless pack of hounds, sounding, belling as hunting dogs do when they are starting after a scent. They were huge, white animals, ghostly in the half-light, loping and jostling and bounding together. They paid not the least attention to the old ones or to anything but Herne on his white horse. Their ears were red, their eyes were red. They were ugly creatures. Will drew back involuntarily as they passed, and one great silvery dog broke stride to glance at him with as casual a curiosity as if he had been a fallen branch. The red eyes in the white head were like flames, and the red ears stood taut upright with a dreadful eagerness, so that Will tried not to imagine what it would be like to be hunted by such dogs. Round Herne and the white mare they bayed and belled, a heaving sea of red-flecked foam. Then all at once the antlered man stiffened, his great horns pointing as a hunting dog points, and he called the hounds together with the rapid, urgent collecting call, the mene, that sends a pack after blood. A bedlam of yelping urgency rose from the milling white dogs filling the sky, and at the same moment the full strength of the thunderstorm erupted. Clouds split roaring into bright, jagged lightning as Herne and the white horse leapt exultantly up into the arena of the sky, with the red-eyed hounds pouring up into the stormy air after them in a great white flood. But then a sudden, terrible silence like suffocation came, blotting out all sound of the storm. In the moment of its last desperate chance, breaking across the barrier that had been holding it at bay, the dark came for Will. Shutting out the sky and the earth, the deadly spinning pillar came at him, dreadful in its furious whirling energy and utter quiet. There was no time for fear. Will stood alone, and the towering black column rushed to engulf him with all the monstrous forces of the dark arrayed in its writhing mist, and at its centre the great foam-mouthed black stallion reared up with the black rider, his eyes two brilliant points of blue fire. Will called vainly on every spell of defence at his command, yet knew that his hands were powerless to move to the signs for help. He stood where he was, despairing, and closed his eyes. But into the dead, world-muffling silence enwrapping him, one small sound came. It was the same strange high whickering far up in the sky, like the passing of many migrant geese on an autumn night, that he had heard three times that day. Nearer, louder it grew, opening his eyes. And he saw then a scene like nothing he had ever seen before, nor ever saw again. Half the sky was thick and dreadful with the silent raging of the dark and its whirling tornado power. But now, riding down towards it, out of the west with the speed of dropping stones, came Herne and the Wild Hunt. At the peak of their power now, in full cry, they came roaring out of that great dark thundercloud, through streaking lightning and grey-purple clouds, riding on the storm. The yellow-eyed, antlered man rode laughing dreadfully, crying out the avant that rallies hounds on the full chase, and his brilliant white-gold horse flung forward with mane and tail flying. And around them, and endlessly behind them, like a broad white river, poured the yell-hounds, the yelpers, the hounds of doom, their red eyes burning with a thousand warning flames. The sky was white with them. They filled the western horizon, and still they came, unending. At the sound of their bell-like thousand-tongued yelping, the magnificence of the dark flinched and swayed and seemed to tremble. Will caught sight of the black rider once more, high in the dark